Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program David Sinho. He is clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. And once a month on a Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, he is here and we talk about personal finance. He begins by making a few comments, sometimes talking a little bit about the economy, sometimes a particular investment topic. And then if you have questions on that or anything else that has to do with investing and money management, I know he will do his best to help you out. All you need to do is just pick up the telephone and call, and we can talk. To start things out, though, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I wanted to take just a few moments this morning and discuss possible investment alternatives for older Americans, especially those individuals who are in their 70s, their 80s, and perhaps even in their 90s, who are interested in safe, income-generating investments, but are disappointed in the current yields on treasuries, on money markets, certificates of deposit, and even AAA corporate bonds. Now, you can pick your poison, but the bottom line is that these high-quality fixed-income investments are yielding somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.75% to perhaps as high as 5.75% if you want to extend your maturities and take a little bit more risk. But basically, we're in that trading range. In fact, interest rates in sort of, well, shall we call it, they're stuck in this range of 4.75% to 5.75%. And our Federal Reserve is in an, well, let's call it an observation mode as opposed to a proactive mode. Interestingly enough, economists are divided on the direction of interest rates over the next 12 months. And the strength of the stock market, at least in the short run, can be, well, partially traced to the belief that the next Federal Reserve move will be to reduce interest rates by reducing the Fed funds rate, which will depress interest rates in general, making it cheaper for companies to borrow, and thereby enhancing the corporate profitability of these companies. That at least is some of the idea, some of the notion of why the stock market continues to be, well, relatively on fire during the first 5 months of this particular year. As for this commentator, with respect to the direction of interest rates, to be honest about it, your guess is as good as mine. And I simply don't have that crystal ball, because if I did, David, why, I'd be in Hawaii, perhaps Maui today, fishing. That's where would I be, although Ed Kezar has really given us a very, very lovely day. Now, in search of higher interest rates for older Americans, they are rediscovering an investment, and really it's a charitable vehicle as well, and it's known as a charitable gift annuity, a CGA, a charitable gift annuity. In fact, in last weekend's edition of the Wall Street Journal, there was really an excellent article explaining charitable gift annuities and their appropriate use. So I'm going to tell you that some of my following comments are excerpted directly from that article. Charitable gift annuities work like this. First of all, you need to find a charitable organization that you want to support. And this particular charitable organization, call it the University of Illinois Foundation, call it your church, your synagogue, your mosque, whatever. Maybe it's another type of nonprofit organization. They will accept your donation, typically cash, but in some cases it might well be stocks or even real estate. And in exchange, essentially for parting with your cash, your stock, or another asset, the charitable organization promises to pay you a fixed annual sum of money, usually quarterly, semi-annually, or perhaps even monthly. And then, in exchange for parting with this money and receiving this monthly, quarterly, annually annuitized payment, you, in addition, can take an upfront tax deduction for a portion of your donation, typically somewhere between 20, 30, 40, perhaps as high as 50%, depending upon your age and a variety of other factors. And to make up for the rest of the deduction you've taken, you receive generally 40 to 50% of your annuity payments tax-free, until you reach your life expectancy. There are some actuarial tables that will tell us what our life expectancy is. Hopefully, you live beyond your life expectancy and you continue to receive these annuitized payments. But at that point in time, the remaining portion will be taxed somewhat differently, usually at ordinary income rates, perhaps even at capital gains rates. It all depends upon the quality of the asset that you originally delivered to the charitable organization. So let's get this straight. We take a lump sum of money, a lump sum asset, we hand it to our charitable organization. Charitable organization says, thank you very much. In consideration of receiving this money, we will pay you for the rest of your life, or in some cases, a joint life, perhaps you and your spouse, a certain fixed amount of money based upon a fixed interest rate. Now, what makes these gift annuities especially attractive are the current interest rates paid to the individuals who give the money to the charitable organization. In other words, when you give this money, you're sort of called an annuitant. Well, what are those current interest rates? And these are rates that are recommended through national associations, typically what is referred to as the American Council on Gift Annuities. They're sort of the Bible on this type of gift, and they recommend what interest rate a charitable foundation should pay its annuitants. At age 70, the rate is 6.5%. And it goes up between the age of 70 and 80, depending upon where you find yourself on that actuarial table. At age 80, the recommended rate is 8%. So if I'm an 80-year-old individual, Dave, I guess you and I are not quite there yet. But, you know, based upon these huge amounts of money that I know you're paid, you're going to be able to be in a position at age 80 to simply gift money back to WILL, and they will then pay you this 8% gift annuity amount for the rest of your life. And hopefully between 80 and 100, you'll still be on the air, commentating, of course, and pontificating a little bit, perhaps, and you'll be earning your 8%. So at age 80, we're talking 8%. And, of course, you get a charitable contribution. If you itemize on your tax return, which you would do, you'd get a pretty hefty tax deduction. And at age 90, well, a lot of people probably aren't buying gift annuities at age 90, but some are. That rate jumps to 11.3% annually. So you can see that when interest rates are low in the economy, this particular type of investment vehicle, one, delivers you higher interest rates, and two, you're essentially meeting some charitable goals as well. So gift annuities pay higher current rates than traditional income investments, and they provide a charitable vehicle as well. Well, that's all the upside. What about the downside of investing in a charitable gift annuity? First, obviously the interest rate is fixed or locked in for life. Hence, it is subject, obviously, to the ravages of inflation. Each annuity payment we would then receive, even though we're receiving the same amount each month, well, it probably has less purchasing power each month so long as we are in an inflationary economy. That payment we receive every month or every quarter is going to buy less cereal, less medical goods, less automobile, less gasoline, whatever, because of the ravages of inflation. We lose purchasing power. Second, annuity payments generally stop at the death of the annuitant, even if the death is premature, before you reach your life expectancy. However, there are exceptions to that rule, and there are means of structuring a gift annuity so as to lessen the impact of a premature death. Finally, one of the potential downsides of charitable gift annuities is that the nonprofit group promising you your lifelong payment suddenly folds. They're no longer there. They're no more. That's a problem, where suddenly you have given substantial amounts of money to a charitable foundation or organization, and they're bankrupt. They're gone. And that means you are not going to receive your payments. Well, obviously, with very, very substantial organizations like the University of Illinois Foundation, very substantial religious organizations, large nonprofits, we really don't have that problem. But what if you want to do this with a smaller nonprofit? Someone, an organization that really doesn't have substantial financial standing, has issues as to financial viability. Well, here's what you can do. You can still do business with them, but you can insist that when you give the money to this organization, they turn right around and reinsure their risk by going out and purchasing an annuity with your money from an insurance company. So thereby, you are guaranteeing, essentially, that you are going to receive these payments. This is not unusual. And in fact, about 10 to 15% of all nonprofit organizations who are in the gift annuity recipient business turn right around, take that money, and reinsure with an insurance company. So that is not unusual. So my advice is, take a hard look at this. The bottom line is that for older Americans seeking higher yields, this may make some good sense, but you've got to understand the product and you've got to be comfortable with the charitable organization that you do business with. And again, you could do this with a number of charities. You're not just limited to one. You could have a charitable gift annuity with one, two, three, four, a dozen different nonprofit organizations. All right. Let's shift gears for a moment and examine, as we do each month, our couch potato portfolio, which, you'll recall, the portfolio consists of 8 stock index funds, which span the large to the small, the U.S. to the international. Well, there's value investing and even real estate indexes in our couch potato portfolio. Now, the actual indexes and their monthly returns are updated on WILL generally once a month after our program. And I believe you go to Focus 580, you click on Focus 580, you then click on links, as I recall, and lo and behold, a number of links come up, including the David Sinnoh Couch Potato Portfolio. Well, how are we doing? Through yesterday's close, our portfolio is ahead 6.96% for the year, and that is including dividends. Interestingly enough, however, the S&P 500 index, including dividends, is ahead 7.36% for the year, which is a bit higher than our couch potato portfolio. Why is that? Well, what has really been dramatically up for the year are big-time companies, especially the Dow Jones and big companies. So those are the companies that are typically in the S&P 500 index, and they are clearly outperforming smaller companies. They are clearly outperforming real estate, which for the first time in over 5 years is negative for the year. Yesterday, our Real Estate Investment Trust Index through yesterday's close was actually down 1.72% for the year. However, maybe because I was good, or perhaps really I'm just lucky, we reduced our real estate investment trust exposure several months ago from a 10% position down to a 7% position. And of course, it pays to invest internationally. Again, international investing is on fire this year. Our total international index through yesterday's close is up some 9.6% for the year. 20% of our portfolio is in this particular index, and the emerging markets still up very, very strongly in spite of high gas prices worldwide, in spite of tricky interest rates worldwide. Emerging markets up some 11.45% for the year. Well, we have a very tiny position, only 5% in emerging markets, but nevertheless, a great diversifier, and that certainly helps. So again, I don't think we have a lot to complain about because really through the middle of May, which is only, what, 4.5 months, we're up 7% in our couch potato portfolio. Now, keep in mind that this is the equity portion of our portfolio. I'm not suggesting that we put all of our money into equities. Remember that you need some fixed income, you need emergency funds, so that you don't have to hemorrhage your equity position in those inevitable periods of times when stocks turn negative. Well, there you have it, David, the couch potato portfolio, a little bit about charitable gift annuities. Be happy to talk about these topics or any other topics that our listeners want to raise.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He is a clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. And if you have questions on anything that he's mentioned here or anything else that has to do with investing, money management, I know he will do his best to help you out. Just give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone here waiting in Urbana, and we'll get right to them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling to check I don't know, I have an idea about making the house payment easier by selling the house and buying a duplex of equal or possibly, you know, slightly higher value, going from a 15-year to a 30-year mortgage and hoping to come out ahead at the end of the year by doing this plus getting a quicker payoff. And I just I don't know necessarily the tax consequences. I don't know if I lose my homeowner status for taxes, and I don't know whether I gain depreciation. So I'm kind of wondering some of the ins and outs about something like that.
Well, you've certainly raised a lot of good questions, and I'll sort of give you the down and dirty rather quickly on this. Now, let me understand the facts that you are going to sell your current house, you're going to take some profit or some other monies from your current house and roll that into a duplex. Is that correct?
That would be the plan.
Okay. Now, number one, have you lived in your house at least 2 consecutive years?
Correct.
All right. So if you have a gain on your house and you are married or single?
Single.
All right. You have the right to have a $250,000 gain on that house exclusive of any tax. So my hope is that you have a $250,000 gain. You probably don't. But any gain, I know, any gain that you've got is not going to be subject to current income tax. That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, when you take your money and you now buy a duplex, and was I correct in understanding you were going to amortize over 30 years?
I'm at 30, and I would actually prefer to go to 15.
Okay,
another payer.
A great idea. And I like duplexes because you can live in one side, treat that as your personal residence, get all the advantages of a personal residence, and actually depreciate the other side and treat that as income property. So I think you're on the right track.
Okay.
And obviously, if you can take a similar asset or perhaps even a larger asset and amortize it over 15 years as opposed to 30 years, I think you're barking up the correct tree, so to speak.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, on a 30-year mortgage, typically, you pay on that mortgage for 10 years. You've paid off about 10 to 15% of that mortgage. Can you imagine?
Right.
You pay on a mortgage for 30 years, you paid off somewhere between 10 and 15% depending upon the interest rate. On the other hand, on a 15-year mortgage, you pay for 10 years, you've paid off at least 50% of that mortgage. Big time difference.
Okay.
So I'm in your corner. I think this is a great idea.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you. Let's talk with someone else also in Urbana. This would be line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I may have missed something when you were talking about the charitable annuity.
Yes.
When you contribute this X amount of money, that then becomes the property of the charity that you're giving it to.
Absolutely. You have dispositively provided a charitable gift. It's an actual gift. You've passed title to the charity.
And if you die within a short time, that is still their property.
It is, but there are some exceptions to that rule. You can structure the gift annuity so that your heirs would at least receive, they would at least receive your principal or a portion of the principal. Some gift annuities can be structured so they are based on more than one life.
Mm-hmm.
They could be based on yours and another individual spouse's
mm-hmm.
life,
mm-hmm.
etc. So there are ways to structure a gift annuity.
And are those alternatives generally available?
Yes.
From most charitable institutions?
For most larger charitable institutions.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Now,
but you have to ask, and it often can be structured, even if it is not available currently, it can be properly structured.
Now, would that then affect, would that work into the total agreement? And if that were the case, then would you expect the return that you receive to be less because you have this other advantage?
Perhaps.
Okay.
All right. But sophisticated charitable foundations are asked these questions all of the time, and they have agreements already. They're called agreement letters.
I see.
Already, and they can answer all of these questions because they have structured these many, many times.
Absolutely. Well, I just wasn't sure what the effect of that having the additional person or having whatever.
Well, clearly, based upon two lives, it is presumed that two lives will last longer than one.
Uh-huh.
So it has an impact mostly on the itemized tax deduction
that you'll
be able to take. It will be a lesser current tax deduction
that
you
would
receive
Rather
on your tax return.
That you would
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, then I understand that, and I thank you for answering that question. Then.
My pleasure. Right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We will continue, and the next person we'll talk to is in Sycamore, up in northwestern Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious about the remainder trust, the charitable gift. It's when you buy an annuity or have them buy an annuity from an insurance company, then does that reduce your effective interest rate, or who eats that, in other words?
No, not really, because what's happening is that they are just going to buy an annuity based upon your actuarial life expectancy. They're not going to take the whole amount of money and use it for an annuity. So if you gifted $100,000, they're going to figure basically on your actuarial life expectancy how much of an annuity they have to buy to just sort of hedge their bet or cover their bets. Now, sometimes they're remember that charitable organizations are buying lots of gift annuities, so they're working on the law of large numbers. So sometimes people are going to live longer. Sometimes people are going to live less long, so to speak. All right?
Okay, thank you
very
much.
So, again, in answer to your question, basically they're going to buy simply an annuity from an insurance company, if they do this, up to your expected life expectancy.
Understood. Okay,
all
thank
right.
you.
Well, thanks for the call. Do the charitable organizations, I sort of hate to put it this way, but is it actually their hope that the person dies and that
on
the whole they'll get more money than they have paid out? I mean, why? What's in it for the charitable organization?
Well, the charitable organization presumes that what they're going to be able to do. Think about it, David. If I'm 80 years of age and I hand $100,000 to this charitable organization and they're going to pay me 8% annually, all right? And I have a pretty good idea based upon the law of large numbers that sometime between 80 and 90, this person is going to die. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reinvesting this money myself. I'm reinvesting this money myself. So if I'm earning 6% on this money and I'm paying out 8, I'm paying out basically $2,000 more a year than I'm earning myself. All right. So my $100,000 gets reduced to $98,000. The $98,000 gets reduced to $96,000. So you can bet that the charitable organization is going to end up with the lion's share of the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, they're not hoping that. In fact, what they're really hoping is that the annuitant is happy with the payout and it will prompt them to make further gifts to charitable foundations. So it's really just the opposite.
Yeah. And for the charitable organization, then this becomes a better deal than if they went out and borrowed that money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, he is here, and we talk about personal finance. It's an opportunity to call in and ask questions about your particular situation, get some advice from him. Obviously, he wants you to do as much research as possible, get a lot of advice. Don't just do something because he says to do it. But this is one place, of course, that you can get some information and ask some basic questions, and that's why we do the show. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Morton Grove, line 3. Hello.
Oh, yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I had a question in connection with the couch potato, the various funds that you mentioned.
Sure.
I wondered, Dave, whether or not it was possible to get the corresponding Vanguard symbols for those funds as opposed to just by name. There are several that are quite similar. And I wanted to make sure I got the right ones. Is that appropriate to ask that question?
That is. You know, I don't have the numerical symbols in front of me. Basically, we could if you go to the Vanguard website.
Yes.
All right. If you're at the Vanguard website, the S&P 500 is obviously the Index 500.
Yes.
You can't miss that one.
No,
I'll give you the
correct.
Easy ones first.
Okay.
And then about 4 index assets after the S&P, it says value, U.S. value. All right? That's the large value that you utilize. I can't remember the number of that particular fund.
Okay.
All right. The small cap is the U.S. small cap index. It is not small cap growth. It's U.S. small cap index.
Okay.
And then right under that, it will say U.S. small cap value index.
Okay.
All right, so you use that. The mid cap index, it says mid cap index. It is not mid cap value index. It's mid cap index.
Okay.
Okay. The REIT is the REIT. There's only one REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust.
Okay.
All right, and that's 7% allocation to the REIT. Finally, there is only one total international index, which is really an amalgam of three other indexes. All right, it's called the Total International Index, which includes Europe, Australia, the Far East, and the emerging markets. And finally, there is the Emerging Markets Index. That's what it's called, Emerging Markets Index.
Okay.
All right, those are the indexes. I think then you can find the corresponding numbers.
Well, that's wonderful. That certainly clarifies it.
Good, good. I'm happy to do that for you.
Well, thank you, and good luck.
All right, then we continue next, coming back here to someone in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Sure.
My daughter's about to turn 18. She's going to be graduating high school.
Congrats.
And thanks. And since she was little, we've been putting a little bit of money when we could aside for her, and we now have about $2,000.
Good.
And the idea was to give it to her as a graduation gift. She doesn't even know it exists.
Wow.
But the alternative could be, we were thinking, that it might be smarter to invest it in something. And, you know, that could grow over time and that she would have access to later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And that might
mm-hmm.
be actually a better gift. But we don't know, like, what to do with it then.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. She's now 18, graduating high school this spring?
Yes.
And is she going to be working over the summer?
No. She's going to be traveling.
Well, that's nice. Is she going to have any income that she is actually going to earn in the year 2006.
2006?
I'm sorry, 2007. I guess I'm living in history here. Is she going to have any job or real earned income in 2007?
She works sometimes at some part-time jobs.
Okay. Well, the only reason I mentioned that is that it would seem to me it would be wonderful if you would establish for her something called a Roth IRA.
Uh-huh.
Now, a Roth IRA is an individual retirement account. And you can establish that down at the local bank, with a mutual fund company, with a brokerage firm, with an insurance company, but maybe with smaller amounts of money, it's just as easy to do it and get started at a local financial institution like
mm-hmm.
a bank,
mm-hmm.
all right, or perhaps a mutual fund company. And a Roth is an individual retirement account. You're putting money in it to save for retirement, but the one rule is that you must have earned income. Either you have self-employment income or you have a job and you're earning a salary.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2007, you can take up to $4,000 of earned income and put it inside this Roth IRA. Now, the beauty of a Roth IRA is that all of the earnings that you put inside a Roth IRA grows tax-free
mm-hmm.
so long as you sort of leave the money for retirement. But there are some other advantages I'm going to tell you about in just a second. So let's say that she earns $1,000 during the year 2007. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I would do is I would take 1,000 of that 2,000 and I would establish a Roth IRA. And the reason I'd like you to go ahead and establish a Roth IRA for her now is that if a Roth IRA basically is in existence for 5 years, which is a little bit after she would be graduating college,
mm-hmm.
she can take up to $10,000 out of a Roth IRA under current rules and apply that toward a down payment on a house.
Mm-hmm.
So if she was really an amazing investor and you took this $1,000 and put it in a Roth IRA, and 5 years later, because of either great investment savvy or pure blind luck, let's just say it was worth $6,000, she could pull all of that out totally tax-free and use it as a down payment on a house.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, with part-time jobs while she's going to school or whatever, she can continue to throw this earned income into this Roth IRA, and the earnings on it will grow tax-free. So I would certainly, this year in 2007, establish for her a Roth IRA, take some of this $2,000 and put it into that. Now, if you establish a Roth IRA at a bank,
mm-hmm.
Then you would use whatever instruments the bank offers for their IRA. Maybe it's a certificate of deposit, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to a mutual fund company, a Fidelity, a T. Rowe Price, a Vanguard, then you would access whatever mutual funds they have available.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be an excellent choice. One is to establish a Roth IRA and then fund it up to the maximum amount of the dollar amount she earns in 2007.
So you could, like, say she doesn't like earn that much now because she's headed to college,
right.
And she's not
yes.
working that much.
Right.
What we could conceive of is any point at which she makes $2,000, and that this money that we've
set aside for her
is the money that could go into that account.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That would be a great use of that money.
Uh-huh.
And it would get her going in a Roth, and it would also then provide an ideal place anytime she has presents, money, et cetera. That would be an ideal place for her to save money.
But the money doesn't actually have to come from some kind of
Doesn't have to come from her. It can come from grandparents, parents. It can come from me if I was crazy enough. It can come from anybody. The trick is, and the key is, that she has to have some earned income.
And does this amount of money that, say she earns $1,000, can people give her gifts worth $3,000?
Yes, but she can only put $1,000 into her Roth.
She can only put as much as she's earned.
Right, with a maximum of $4,000 in 2007, and in 2008, the number goes to $5,000.
Okay, and it can't be retroactive. She had a good paying job last year.
Not in 2006. Sorry.
Okay.
Too late.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Right, my pleasure.
Thank you. We're a bit past the midpoint here. Dave Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. And monthly on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. 333-9455 is the number if you'd like to call in here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Up next, someone else in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. What is your view of tax-free mutual funds?
Well, I like very short-term tax-free mutual funds, but I am not very excited about long-term tax-free mutual funds. In fact, I'm not very excited about any long-term bond funds. So if you're in a tax-free mutual fund, which is really a bond fund, and has an average maturity of somewhere between 1 and 3 years, then I like those kinds of funds, so long as it is a high-quality fund. It has to be a high-quality fund that holds mostly general obligation municipal bonds. Then I don't have a problem with it. Obviously, you can buy general obligation bonds on your own. Then you want to obviously stick with AAA credits. But as a general rule, right now there are some tax advantages, especially if you're in a very, very high federal income tax rate. But again, you want to stay very short. So look at the average maturity and the average duration of those funds and make sure it's on the short side of the equation.
And what does the shortness do for you?
Well, the shortness reduces the volatility of the day-to-day fluctuation in the price. If suddenly interest rates shoot up in the economy, those bonds are going to be worth less money, and as a result, your shareholder value is going to go down. So even though you are getting interest income on those bonds, your total return could well drop to zero, even a negative number, because of the shareholder price. And when interest rates go up, bond fund managers have this bad habit of chasing yield. So they sell off these bonds at a discount, which you can never recover from because that impacts your negative value, your NAV, your net asset value, and then they go chase newer bonds with higher interest rates. So again, it doesn't have much of an impact if you're in very, very short-term bonds or bond funds.
Thank you very much.
All right,
my pleasure.
You. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
David, I noticed that we had a lot of questions about gift annuities, and I want to remind the listeners that when we're talking about gift annuities, we're talking about a fixed interest rate that is paid to the annuitant. Can I, for example, hand $100,000 or $10,000 to a nonprofit organization and say, I'd like a variable rate of return. I'd like you to invest this money, for example, in the stock market, and then I'll take my chances because maybe I'll earn a higher rate of return. Now, that type of vehicle is very, very popular as well, but it is not called a gift annuity. It is basically referred to as a charitable remainder unit trust. So if you hear the term charitable remainder unit trust, that's a situation where we're actually taking money, handing it to a nonprofit organization. They're investing it in a pool professionally managed of stocks, perhaps some bonds and mutual funds, etc. And then, depending upon how that giant pool does, that will depend upon what kind of annuitized payment I'm going to receive, either monthly, quarterly, annually, etc. So if you have a little bit more stomach for risk, then you can go into a charitable remainder unit trust. You're going to get basically the same kind of tax deduction as you would get with a gift annuity, but now you're taking more of the investment risk as opposed to just a straight interest rate of return. Mm.
So there I was thinking, why, if you're going to do that, why not just go ahead and put your money into a mutual fund? There, obviously, there what you're missing out is the tax break that
Absolutely.
You get from making the initial contribution.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's why you would
imagine
that. Okay.
Imagine that. Exactly.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two quick questions. One, I'm a small business owner, and I was wondering to pay my child a W-2, and with the income level of $4,000, then can that child put that money in a Roth IRA, and does that make sense to do?
Well, the answer is that if a child earns income, receives a W-2, and performs some services, so it cannot be construed just as an outright gift, then your child certainly can take that up to $4,000 and put that in a Roth IRA. That's number one. Number two, keep in mind that $4,000 is subject to payroll tax. So the check is going, the $4,000 is going to be subject to 7.65 Medicare and Social Security, as well as your company as a small business owner is going to pay 7.65 on that $4,000 or 15.3%. Follow me?
And then I'm able to tax deduct it, though.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. If it's necessary and an ordinary business expense, and as long as it can be defended as a necessary and ordinary business expense, you can deduct it.
Okay, so my child can clean the office and
you bet.
Clean the windows.
Absolutely, and a lot of kids do this for their parents who are in small businesses. No problem with that as long as it's documented and performs meaningful work. And, hey, if you could pay your child to do this as opposed to a janitorial service, so much the better.
Yeah, and then after 5 years, they can take it out. Is that correct?
Well, here's the bottom line, and it's a little bit misunderstood. Any principal contributions that are made into a Roth IRA, interestingly enough, regardless of age or time, they come out tax-free if you really need the money.
Oh, that's
good. The five-year rule says that if you put some money into a Roth, and let's just say it grew, you put in $5,000 over a period of time and it grew to $15,000, I could take my $5,000 of original contributions, $5,000 of my gain, which makes $10,000, and then I could take that $10,000 and utilize it for a down payment on a house.
That's great.
All right?
Yes, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. That's toll-free line if you want to call in here. You have a question for our guest, David Sinem.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about just briefly while we're waiting on a couple of additional calls are the REITs, the real estate investment trusts. And basically, as I've told our audience before, REITs are nothing more than corporations. Usually they are publicly traded corporations which invest in real estate. They buy, they sell, they own, they manage real estate. And then presumably they distribute their profits back to their shareholders in the form of dividends. The advantage of REITs, of course, are that even though they are corporations, they escape double taxation, so long as they distribute 90% of this money that they're making back to their individual shareholders. And REITs have had this tremendous, tremendous run over the last 5 years with compounded rates of return in excess of 20%, which, of course, for people who had the couch potato portfolio over the last several years have had to be very, very happy. Now, earlier in the year, we cut our REIT position back from 10, basically down to 7. And we did that for a number of reasons. One is the asset class was so hot for so long, eventually it has to come back to its mean level of returns. It just can't continue at 20% forever. So as a result, it's rather interesting to note that this year, through yesterday's close, the REIT indexes are actually negative for the year. So REITs have actually lost money this year in terms of their net asset value as compared to the dividends that they have provided to their shareholders. We know that real estate all across the country, well, it's sort of in a funk, but there's real estate markets that are actually doing quite well. We can look at the Seattle market. Interestingly enough, some of the Texas markets. Austin, Texas, is doing very, very well. And the markets that seem to be doing best, actually positive for the last 12 to 18 months, are markets that came out of the recession late, are doing well now. And the key in any area when you look to buy real estate, especially residential real estate, is job creation. Good job creation. If you are going to be moving, looking to buy real estate, are you moving to an area where jobs are being created? What we find out, and that seems to be the best correlation between housing prices and jobs. If we are in an area where we're continuing to create jobs, housing prices continue to either stabilize or indeed escalate. So if you're moving from one area to another, look at that statistic. What's going on with meaningful job creation in your area? And obviously, some of the areas that have been really hard hit, like Florida, which are mostly tourist areas, you're not seeing a lot of job creation other than in the construction industry, which is now slowing down. And that's had a major impact, for example, in the Florida markets.
Okay, well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have a caller in Chicago. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask your guest, do you remember when Ford, or General Motors rather than Ford, had this buyout program where they offered $140,000 to every one who agreed to leave early? If you're, say, 58 years old, would you take that?
Would I take that if I was 58 years old and GM and Ford were offering me $140,000
to leave?
Yeah. And I still had my defined benefit pension. So I'm asking you, what other benefits do I have? Do all my other benefits?
I'm not sure the pension was part of it. I think it was just a buyout program, but I don't know if they let them keep their pension or not. Now I'm thinking if they didn't keep their pension, I'm thinking not.
Well, I think that when you're 58 years of age, it's an issue of how many years you have into the pension system. That's what I'm getting at.
I see.
Ford isn't taking away your pension. GM isn't taking away your pension. The issue is how many years do I have in the pension system? And the other question is, let's face it, both the Ford pension and the General Motors pension are woefully underfunded. Underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, if General Motors or Ford are not around, then there is a serious question as to what kind of pension benefits one would ultimately receive.
Well,
and what has happened in the past, of course, is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation has had to step in, but that there is a limit to the amount of dollars that one receives when the government steps in. It may indeed be less than the outstanding pension that you are expecting.
Well, that's true. And also, what about this? And I apologize to you ahead of time. You take the money, you put $40,000 into a Roth IRA, and then you live on the rest of it till you can find another job.
Well, there's a couple of problems. One is you can only put $4,000 or $5,000 a year into a Roth IRA.
I see.
You can't put $40,000. And number two, when you leave a company, what happens to your health benefits?
They go.
I don't want to be 58 years of age and naked with no health benefits. That's a big problem. One is I'm not even sure I can get health insurance. And two, if I can get it, it might cost me $10,000 a year. And I still might have to only have a major medical where I maybe have a $10,000 deductible. That's a problem. It's a big time problem.
$140,000 sounds like a lot of money. But in fact, I figured the way the Ford workers are being paid, it's just about what? 2-3 years salary is about.
Well, think about it. $140,000, if you take it, that's ordinary income.
Yeah.
All right? What's the tax on $140,000 layered on to other income? Once you pay your Social Security, once you pay your Medicare, once you pay your federal income tax and your state income tax, I think I can make a pretty good argument that a third of it at least is going to disappear right out of the box. All right?
So
we're not talking about 140. We're talking about 67% of 140, or we're talking somewhere around maybe $90,000 to $100,000. Now I've got to go out and buy some medical, all right? And I have no job. And how am I going to pay for my fancy bass boat? And how am I going to pay for my nice General Motors or Ford ride, which I got at a discount? So that's why I bought a GM or a Ford, because I'm an employee, and I might have a payment on that. I think it's, you know, you need a financial advisor. That's what I'm saying.
So you're saying maybe it might not be a good idea to maybe you should just let it go.
Well, what I'm saying is that you need some professional advice to examine exactly what position am I in financially if I take the buyout. And what is the alternative if I don't?
Yeah, Ford and the trouble is Ford and General Motors usually pay their employees pretty good, and I think they got a little spoiled. You know, that can happen when you're making $20-25 an hour.
You bet. You bet. You bet. And they worked hard, and it was great, and it's one of the saddest commentaries in America that we are in this position with GM and Ford, who literally built this country.
I want to thank the caller. I want to see if I can get one more at least. Come back here to Danville, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I wonder if you would compare for me the advantages of book entry versus certificate or vice versa.
Okay. If you're holding certificates, you are then doing all of the bookkeeping yourself. You're getting all of the paperwork from the companies, and you have to keep track of all of your dividends. Now, it's great to have certificates in your lockbox, but let me tell you, and I hope you're a young person, but when someone dies and they have lots and lots of certificates in their lockbox, it is a bloody mess to transfer them as part of an estate plan, and a lawyer is going to make a lot of money, and the lawyer doesn't even want to do this themselves. So my reaction is to take all of those certificates and put them in book entry with an appropriate financial organization, a Charles Schwab, a Fidelity, a Vanguard, a Merrill Lynch. There is generally no charge for simply warehousing your securities, and let them be your bookkeeper. Then, in the event of death, it's very, very simple to transfer an account as opposed to individual securities. So
well,
my
what
vote
I'm concerned
is,
about is selling.
Well, it's if you want to sell a security, then do it through a discounter. So go to a discounter
no,
and sell.
The point I thought was that if you want to sell something you have in security form, then you can call your broker and say, I will sell this at such and such amount. And with book entry, you can't do that. Is that true?
Not absolutely untrue. You can put in a market order. You can put in a limit order. You can put in a stop limit order. You can put in any kind of order you want.
With book entry.
Absolutely.
All right, then.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a minute or two left. I don't know if there's anything in particular that you'd just like to mention to folks to finish up.
Well, I think that we have to be very, very careful about chasing interest rates. I want to urge people not to chase interest rates. There are some teaser interest rates out there. For example, if you tie your money up for X number of years, then you're going to get a higher interest rate. I'm very concerned about that because no one really understands the direction of interest rates. I think that's a major mistake. Tying your money up more than a year or two, I'm just dead set against that approach. And for goodness sake, if you're going to chase interest rates, don't buy low-quality financial instruments. There's just not enough of a yield spread between high-quality and low-quality instruments to take the risk of purchasing lower-quality instruments just to chase yield.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that was in my mind, just to, again, to hit on, if particularly those people who have some money, they want to put it someplace where it will earn them some interest. Maybe they don't need it right now. They want to make sure that it's safe and secure. And the simplest thing is to go down to your bank and get a certificate of deposit.
It's pretty darn simple, and they're pretty darn competitive.
And then they'll say to you, okay, well, how long do you want this to go for? We got a fabulous deal here on a CD that might, you know, obviously the longer you're willing to give them the money for, the more interest they will pay you.
Usually. You would think so, even though we're in a little bit of what's called an inverted yield curve. But at the banks, that still seems to be the case.
But you would still, sounds like you would still say not more than 24 months.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Not more than 24 months.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
David, it's really been a pleasure. Lots of fun with these questions today.
David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. He is here on the program once a month, and we talk about financial planning and money management. It's always on a Friday.